Okay, good evening. Welcome to the library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. We're here just a couple of days before Yom HaShoah, so this is obviously very appropriately timed. It is our privilege and our pleasure to welcome a very distinguished gentleman and editor of the volume that you know you've come to hear spoken about. So I won't say a lot about what you already know. You saw the bio and you saw a basic description of the book. What I'd like to add, I had a few minutes to speak with Menachem before our event right now, and had a chance to ask him about how the book came about, how the essays were invited, the authors of the essays that are collected in this wonderful volume. It's 88 separate essays. It's really very rich with a range of people writing from a very diverse set of backgrounds, but with one thing in common, that is to say that they are all children or grandchildren, right, of individuals who suffered through the Holocaust and survived. They're insights that will be familiar to some of you, but also insights that will challenge each and every one of us, regardless of who we might be. The essays were invited. Sometimes individuals were known for their inclination, for their preference. They're historians, they're lay people, they're rabbis, they're theologians. And the invitation said, we'd like you to write in the following direction, because we know who you are and the kind of writing or the kind of speaking that you do. And Menachem told me beforehand that, lo and behold, sometimes that worked. But sometimes, I guess to no one's surprise, people wrote things that were not anticipated, but were that much richer for that. Long and short. As I said, very, very diverse. When you open the volume, you'll find that the editor organized these essays into a number of very distinct categories. And what's wonderful about the book is that you can dip into it and read an essay here and an essay there, and then go back to it time and time again. So this will be a resource for you over the course of time. Now, this Yom HaShoah, next Yom HaShoah, for years to come or any time in between, because this, of course, is a focus, a concern, a legacy that will really compel the Jewish community, not only in this generation, but into generations to come. So I hope that provides just a little bit of an introduction and that it is at least barely adequate. I usually say at the beginnings of these talks that we at the library here at JTS, what organizes these events is that we want to bring your attention to significant new books of Jewish interest. And there is no doubt that this is such a book. And so I introduce to you its editor, Menachem Rosensaft.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kramer. It's tremendous privilege for me to be here. The last time I was in the library at great length was in 1985 for the dedication of the, I guess it's a, not quite a mural, that the Rappaport mural, and at that time Rabbi Dr. Gerson Cohen had asked me to chair the committee for the installation, and it's a tremendous privilege to be back here. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, we have to have a discussion if you were involved in that, because we actually had an event drawing attention to our Holocaust Memorial last year, and there was no one around who actually had the history of it. So,
yes,
now you can provide us as a resource.
With great pleasure. what I'd like to do is not so much talk about the book. I find that for an author or an editor to talk about the book is basically providing a summary, in which case, why bother reading the book? On the other hand, what I would like to do tonight, especially since we are approaching Yom HaShoah, is to try to put the book somewhat in a historical context, and then to talk a little bit and maybe have a discussion afterwards about where we go from here with respect to Holocaust remembrance. The Messiah, wrote Franz Kafka in one of his parables, will only come when he will no longer be needed. He will only come on the day after his arrival. He will come not on the last day, but on the very last. On January 27, 1945, when the soldiers of the Red Army entered the three-camp complex of Auschwitz-Birkenau, also known as Auschwitz II, and Bunimanowitz, near the southern Polish town of Oświęcim, collectively often referred to simply as Auschwitz, only around 7,000 inmates, many of whom were dying, remained in what had been the largest, most efficient, most diabolical killing site in history. An estimated 1.1 million men, women, and children, the overwhelming majority of them Jews, but also Poles, Roma and Sinti, Soviet prisoners of wars, and others, had been systematically murdered there. Among them were my parents, among them were my grandparents, my 5.5-year-old brother, and most of the members of my parents' families. My mother spent over 15 months at Birkenau. My father, who was first deported to Auschwitz-Birkenau in late August of 1943, and then, after escaping and being captured, was tortured for months in the notorious Block 11, also known as the Death Block at Auschwitz. The liberators had come too late for the dead. And even the living who had passed through Auschwitz-Birkenau were left with unspeakable memories. Upon arrival at Birkenau, Marie-Claude Vaillant-Couturier testified before the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. Quote, "We were led to a large shed, then to the disinfecting station. There our heads were shaved and our registration numbers were tattooed on the left forearm. Then we were taken into a large room for a steam bath and a cold shower. In spite of the fact that we were naked, all this took place in the presence of SS men and women. We were then given clothing which was soiled and torn, a cotton dress and jacket of the same material. At Auschwitz-Birkenau, men, women, and children were herded into gas chambers to suffer an agonizing collective death. Here, the corpses were incinerated in huge crematoria. Sometimes, not only the corpses. One night," Marie-Claude Vaillant-Couturier recalled at Nuremberg, "we were awakened by terrifying cries, and we discovered on the following day that on the preceding day, the gas supply having run out, they had thrown the children into the furnaces alive." To be sure, Auschwitz was not the only Nazi death camp where Jews had been gassed as part of what German government officials euphemistically termed the final solution of the Jewish question. Treblinka, Majdanek, Chelmno, Belzec, and Sobibor were the other principal annihilation centers the Germans had set up in Poland. But it is Auschwitz-Birkenau that has come to be symbolic of absolute evil. It epitomizes the horrors of both the Holocaust specifically and the broader monstrosities that have become categorized as genocide. As World War II came to an end, Allied troops liberated other Nazi camps, mostly in April and May of 1945. Among them, Buchenwald and Dora Mittelbau on April 11th, that's 3 days ago, 70 years ago today, Bergen-Belsen on April 15th, that's tomorrow, Sachsenhausen on April 22nd, Dachau on April 29th, Mauthausen in Austria on May 6th, and Terezin, Theresienstadt in what was then Czechoslovakia, today the Czech Republic, on May 8th. And in each of these camps, the newly freed prisoners were confronted with a grim and frightening new reality. The hand of Adonai came upon me, declared the prophet Ezekiel. He took me out by the spirit of Adonai and set me down in the valley. It was full of bones. He led me all around them. There were very many of them spread over the valley. And they were very dry. He said to me, Son of man, can these bones live again? And I replied, O Lord Adonai, only you know. And he said to me, Prophesy over these bones and say to them, O dry bones, hear the words of Adonai. Thus said the Lord Adonai Elohim to these bones, I will cause breath to enter you and you shall live again. In a lecture describing condition at Bergen-Belsen when that camp was liberated, Lieutenant Colonel M.W. Gonin, the British officer who commanded the 11th Light Field Ambulance during the camp's liberation, said that they were, and I quote, at least 20,000 sick suffering from the most virulent diseases known to man, all of whom required urgent hospital treatment, and 30,000 men and women who might die if they were not treated, but who certainly would die if they were not fed and removed from the horror camp. What we had not got was nurses, doctors, beds, bedding, clothes, drugs, dressings, thermometers, bedpans, or any of the essentials of medical treatment, and worst of all, no common language. Within a few days following the liberation, Brigadier H.L. Glyn Hughes, the Deputy Director of Medical Services of the British Army of the Rhine, appointed my mother, a not yet 33-year-old Jewish dentist from Sosnowiec, Poland, who had studied medicine in France, to organize and head a group of doctors, nurses, and other volunteers among the survivors to help care for the camp's thousands of critically ill inmates. She had been sent to Bergen-Belsen from Auschwitz in November 1944 and, together with a group of other Jewish women inmates, had kept 149 Jewish children alive despite the lack of food and a raging typhus epidemic. For weeks on end, my mother and her team of 28 doctors and 620 other female and male volunteers, only a few of whom were trained nurses, worked round the clock with the British military medical personnel to try to save as many of the survivors as possible. Despite their desperate efforts, it was not until May 11, 1945, that the daily death rate fell below 100. The Holocaust claimed 13,944 additional victims at Bergen-Belsen during the 2 months after the liberation. Ezekiel continued, and he said to me, O son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say, our bones are dried up, our hope is gone, we are doomed. Prophesy, therefore, and say to them, thus said the Lord Adonai, I am going to open your grave and lift you out of the grave, O my people, and bring you to the land of Israel. I will put my breath into you, and you shall live again. In due course, Ezekiel's prophecy would come to pass, but it would take time, considerable time. The end of the war found the survivors alone, mostly abandoned. For the greater part of the liberated Jews of Bergen-Belsen, my mother recalled many years later, there was no ecstasy, no joy at our liberation. We had lost our families, our homes. We had no place to go, nobody to hug, nobody who was waiting for us anywhere. We had been liberated from death and from the fear of death, but we were not free from the fear of life. And yet, the survivors, who could easily have given up on humankind, chose to return to life. In displaced person camps across Germany, Austria, and Italy, they returned to life spiritually, physically, culturally, and socially. Instead of allowing themselves to remain the prisoners of a horrific past, they looked toward the future, started new families, and proved, if only to themselves, that they had not only remained alive, but that they had, in fact, prevailed. Before turning toward the future, let us reflect tonight, at least for a few moments, on Holocaust remembrance. Coming to terms with Shoah memory, if you will, as it has evolved over the past 70 years. Over the course of these past 7 decades, our perspective on the past has undergone and is continuing to undergo a subtle yet perceptible transformation. Time has not diminished our grief. Our questions, whether addressed to God or to humankind, remain unanswered. But somehow, our horror and outrage seem to have eased, if not lessened. Auschwitz, Treblinka, Bergen-Belsen, Babi Yar, the Warsaw Ghetto, gas chambers, selections, partisans, Yellow Stars of David, crematoria, mass graves. Names, terms, and concepts that entered our vocabulary in a dramatic explosion of emotion have become almost too familiar. The sense of awe that once characterized even the most oblique reference to the annihilation of European Jewry has evolved into standardized, often impersonal, reactions. For most of the first quarter century after the end of the Second World War, those of us who are old enough to remember will recall, the study of the Holocaust was the domain of an isolated few, most of whom saw their task as a solemn obligation primarily to the dead. But then, historical accounts and memoirs devoted to this cataclysm, better ones, worse ones, began appearing regularly. The Holocaust also entered popular culture with a vengeance. The trend began slowly in the 1960s with films like The Pawnbroker in 1964, The Shop on Main Street the following year, and The Garden of the Finzi Contini in 1970, making vast audiences around the world aware for the first time of the suffering to which European Jewry had been subjected. These were followed by the popular but historically questionable NBC television miniseries Holocaust in 1978, François Truffaut's Le Dernier Métro, The Last Metro, Louis Malle's Au revoir les enfants, Goodbye Children, and Agnieszka Holland's Europa, Europa in 1990, among many films and television productions of the era. Steven Spielberg's monumental 1993 motion picture, Schindler's List, not to mention such words as Roberto Benigni's cringe-producing Life is Beautiful and Roman Polanski's The Pianist, made the subject truly fashionable, even trendy. Then there are the countless lectures, courses, sermons, articles, Life in the Ghettos, Face in the Camps, Hidden Children, Love in the Shadow of Death, Accusation of Collaboration with the Enemy, Death Marches, Watching Loved Ones Disappear Forever, Emotional Reunion in Displaced Persons Camps, Survivors Coming to Terms with Their Loss, Post-Holocaust Trauma. No aspect of the Shoah has been left untouched, undissected. While many of these works are important and factually accurate contribution to the historical record, others are flawed in a variety of ways. In a desire for drama, an author will occasionally expand on the truth. A minor participant in an uprising may be tempted, in writing his or her memoirs, to embellish his or her own role. A publisher, seeking to enhance a forthcoming book's appeal, may urge a writer to add some romance to an otherwise colorless episode. A less than meticulous historian may transpose a given occurrence from Auschwitz to Treblinka in order to streamline a particular argument. As much as any other event, if not more so, the Holocaust requires the chronicler to be scrupulously accurate. The historian who misrepresents it commits a greater transgression than one who shunned the topic altogether. The witness who testifies falsely who distorts his or her experiences in any manner for even the most benign reason, effectively become the accomplice of those who try to deny that the Holocaust ever took place. This is not to suggest that the current widespread interest in the Shoah is not welcomed. But the greater the popularity of the subject, the greater the need for vigilance regarding the treatment it is accorded. In Washington, D.C., the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum has brought the full magnitude and complexity of the Holocaust into the consciousness of thousands upon thousands of Americans every single week since it opened 22 years ago. Most of the millions of visitors who have been to the museum are non-Jews. Who among us could have predicted 20, 30, or 40 years ago that American public schools and church groups would make reservations months in advance to visit a Holocaust museum? Who among us could have predicted in the mid-1960s, when some of us became of age, that serious scholars would make Holocaust studies a respected academic discipline? Why, then, is there also a sense of unease? Why am I, for one, not altogether comfortable with the popular appeal that the Holocaust has acquired? Perhaps because the experience must not be allowed to lose its aura of mystery. Objective cognitive analysis alone is insufficient. As Elie Wiesel has written, Auschwitz signifies not only the failure of 2,000 years of Christian civilization, but also the defeat of the intellect that wants to find a meaning with a capital M in history. What Auschwitz embodied had none. The Holocaust transcends ordinary human experience. It is, in fact, the unprecedented, the unfathomable, and above all, the inexplicable. Sober chronologies of dates, events, and statistics are critical to our understanding, but provide only one dimension. Histories of the Holocaust, based exclusively or even primarily on German documents, such as Raoul Hilberg's history, convey the intent and actions of the perpetrators, but do not adequately reflect the experiences of the victims. Thus, ghetto diaries, underground newspapers, and survivors' recollections are essential to any comprehensive narrative. And no one can penetrate the nocturnal universe of Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen without absorbing songs, poems, nightmares, and prayers that defy all standard historiographic methodology. A barrack wall at Auschwitz contained the following inscription: Andreas Rappaport lived 16 years. Try to imagine this boy, realizing that he was about to die, as he tried to leave a sign, a memory, of his existence on earth. In truth, Andreas Rappaport was the author of his own eulogy. Andreas Rappaport lived 16 years. Andreas Rappaport, abandoned, alone, afraid. Andreas Rappaport, hungry, in pain. Andreas Rappaport, gas-filled lungs. Andreas Rappaport, burning flesh in the crematorium, black smoke, ashes. With the passing of time, our mental pictures go out of focus. Our collective memories become blurred. We all have memories, even we who were born afterward, and they were once fresh. When my father told me how he was shot by the Germans while escaping from a moving train for Auschwitz, when he told me how his 80-year-old father died in his arms, when he told me how he was tortured for months in Block 11 at Auschwitz, every one of his experiences was sharply recorded in my mind. He died almost 40 years ago, and I no longer remember his words as clearly as I once did. We all have memories of when we first realized the enormity of Hitler's final solution of the Jewish question, of the first time we tried to imagine members of our own families gasping for air in a gas chamber. But the years have mellowed our reactions. It used to be that we could not sleep for days after seeing a film about the Shoah. Now such films are shown on television late at night and no longer have the same impact. As our knowledge of the Holocaust steadily increases, we must be careful not to become desensitized. As we perpetuate memory, we must also prevent it from becoming commonplace. There are times when even scholars must abandon their dispassion. Remembrance without emotion is hollow, and the dead deserve our anguish. And now, in this context, and against this background, let us look briefly at those of us, the children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, who are increasingly taking on the task of guardians of Shoah memory. The reality is that many, if not most of us, live with ghosts. We are haunted much in the way a cemetery is haunted. We bear within us the shadows and echoes of an anguished dying we never experienced or witnessed. One of my ghosts is a little boy named Benjamin, who arrived at the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp with his parents on the night of August 3rd to 4th, 1943. In her posthumously published memoirs, my mother recalled her final moment with her son, my brother. And I quote, "We were guarded by SS men and women. One SS man was standing in front of the people and he started the selection. With a single movement of his finger, he was sending some people to the right and some to the left. Men were separated from women. People with children were sent to one side and young people were separated from older looking ones. No one was allowed to go from one group to the other. Our 5.5-year-old son went with his father. Something that will haunt me to the end of my days occurred during those first moments. As we were separated, our son turned to me and asked, 'Mommy, are we going to live or die?' I didn't answer this question." Benjamin is one of between 1 million and 1.5 million Jewish children who were murdered in the Holocaust. Since my mother's death in 1997, he has existed inside of me. I see his face in my mind, try to imagine his voice, his fear of the gas chamber's door slammed shut, his final tears. If I were to forget him, he would disappear. 70 years after the liberation of Auschwitz, as we mark the 70th anniversaries of the liberation of the Nazi death and concentration camps and the end of World War II, we are at a transitional moment. For the past 70 years, the survivors of the Shoah kept the memory of what had been done to them, to their families, and to European Jewry at the forefront of their society's consciousness. Sadly, but inevitably, they are now fading from the scene. The critical question for us, therefore, is how their absence will change the nature of Holocaust remembrance. Historian Lucy Davidovich once described my father, who had survived, as I mentioned, months of torture in Block 11 at Auschwitz, as well as the cavernous underground tunnels of Dora Mittelbau, where Wernher von Braun's V-2 rocket were manufactured, and Bergen-Belsen, as, and I quote, "Our ancient mariner who passes like night from land to land with strange power of speech to tell his tale to whomsoever will listen." The same is true of many of the survivors, each haunted by, at times obsessed with, his or her own memory. Now they have entrusted the principal responsibility for preserving and perpetuating these memories to their children and grandchildren as a hallowed inheritance that we in turn must transmit to our own and to future generations, Jews and non-Jews alike, not with the survivor's fervor and intensity, but with our own. Such an intergenerational transmission of memory is not a new phenomenon. When Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, saw that the Jewish people were threatened by tragedy, Elie Wiesel wrote 50 years ago in the preface to his novel, The Gate of the Forest, he would go to a particular place in the forest where he lit a fire, recited a particular prayer, and the miracle was accomplished, averting the tragedy. In the next generation, where the Baal Shem Tov disciple, the Maggid of Mezherich, had to intervene with heaven for the same reason, He went to the same place in the forest where he told the master of the universe that while he did not know how to light the fire, he could still recite the prayer, and again the miracle was accomplished. A generation later still, when it was the turn of Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sasov, a disciple of the Maggid of Mezerich, to try to avert a catastrophe, Rabbi Moshe Leib went into the forest and pleaded with God that while he did not know how to light the fire and did not know the prayer, he could still find the place. And yet again, the miracle occurred. And then, when it came the turn of Rabbi Israel of Rizhin, the great grandson of the Maggid of Mezerich, who was named after the Baal Shem Tov, to intercede with God, he sat in his armchair, holding his head in his hands, and said, "I am unable to light the fire. I do not know the prayer, and I cannot even find the place in the forest. All I can do is tell the story. That must be enough." And, wrote Elie Wiesel, it was sufficient. And so it has been for many of the survivors, each haunted by, at times obsessed with, his or her own memories. Some were able to impart them to others. Many were unable to translate them into words. They knew the places and the fires in their unique forests, places with names like Auschwitz, Treblinka, Babi Yar, Transnistria, like no one else in the world could, for they had been there then. And when they did speak, they created a spark within us who were privileged to listen and to learn from them. For us, the children and grandchildren of the survivors, it must be different. While we can never truly know what the survivors experience, we endeavor to perpetuate and pass on the legacy of memory we receive from them, but this hallowed inheritance is of necessity modified by our own experiences and perspectives. I have no delusions that the legacy that curled within my sentences and stand beside me at the lectern makes what I do special in any way, observed novelist and law professor Sane Rosenbaum. What was unique, what was miraculous, was that anyone had survived. The fact that the children of survivors built lives of their own based on the contorted architecture of their parents' suffering is neither surprising nor in any way exceptional. The children were not actually there. They are merely the artifact of the aftermath. Witnesses not to the event itself, but to the absurdity of an afterlife at all. Their knowledge is limited in as much as their legacy is non-transferable. And yet, Rosenbaum concludes, the human condition is a canvas, and leaving it blank is not an option. Something must be said, some things must be written. Some outrages must produce a scream of a deafening frequency. A legacy that goes ignored eventually limps back. We are all to some degree answering the call of the concentration camps. Not as eyewitnesses, but as dutiful sons and daughters. My mother died hours after the end of Rosh Hashanah in 1997. 6 months later, I took our daughter Jody, then a college sophomore, to Poland for the first time. She and my mother had been very close and had spent a great deal of time together as Jody was growing up. We went to Warsaw and Krakow, and then to Auschwitz. It was a gray day with a constant drizzle. I showed Jody block 11, the desk block where my father was tortured for months, and then we went to Birkenau. We walked in silence past the decaying wooden barracks. After 15 or 20 minutes, Jody turned to me and said, "You know, it looks exactly the way Dasa," which is what she called my mother, Hadassah, described it. In that moment, I realized that a transfer of memory had taken place. My daughter, born 33 years after the Holocaust, had recognized Birkenau through my mother's eyes, through my mother's memories, which Jody had absorbed into her own consciousness. Many children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors have experienced this type of epiphany. For Stephanie Butnick, it came on a visit to what had been the concentration and displaced person camp of Bergen-Belsen, where, and I quote, I learned about my grandparents from the friend they had made at the DP camp, who had become lifelong friends after they all immigrated to the United States. I heard stories and saw archival photographs of a theater troupe my grandparents were a part of, and I ate meals in the same dining hall they would have eaten in after liberation. Here, in this strange, unsettling place, I felt closer to them than I ever had. During Shabbat services in Rabbi Lily Kaufman's childhood synagogue, two men would periodically erupt in screams. The rabbi and the chazan, she recalls, and I quote, would wait out the screams, whether during the sermoning or the davening. It was whispered among us children that they had been in a concentration camp and had gone mad. This madness was accepted. If they could not scream here, in Shul, before the Holy Ark, before God and the Jewish people, where could they? If our community could not accept the inconvenient consequences of brutality and the justice of their bitter and chaotic protest against it, who could? Shabbos was to be protected, but not at the cost of our humanity, of our chesed, our kindness. Justice Rosalie Silberman Abella's father was 35 years old at the end of World War II, and her mother was 28. As I reach each of these ages, she writes, I try to imagine how they felt when they faced an unknown future as survivors of an unimaginable past. And as each of my sons reached the age my brother had been when he was killed, I try to imagine my parents' pain at losing their 2-year-old son. I couldn't. For Rabbi Judy Schindler, meanwhile, the memory of my family members who died in the Holocaust and the voices of those who survived motivate my everyday action. Their voices continually speak to me as I share the messages of their lives and deaths with the world. Rabbi Schindler does not sleep much. The voices of the Holocaust keep her awake at night and alert during the day. Occasionally, she writes, I have nightmares of anti-Semitism that cast my family from the shelter of safety and democracy and the freedom we know. I create educational documentaries on diversity and inclusion that I use in schools, businesses, congregations, and communities across our country so that all minorities are safe and so that we as Jews are also safe. My family tree filled with lives murdered by Nazi evil does not allow me the luxury of silence and complicity in the face of hatred. Dr. Eva Fogelman remembers sitting with her father on Cape Cod when he told her that the rosehip bushes beside them reminded him of the berries he had eaten as a partisan in the forests of Belarus. Aviva Tal recounts a story her mother once told her of how she and a group of other women inmates at the Ravensbrück concentration camp began to laugh hysterically while being forced to carry heavy loads of coal when one of them began to sing in Yiddish, I thank you, Gotten you, dear God, that I am a Jew. Former New York Times reporter Joseph Berger, remembers his father telling him at the Western Wall in Jerusalem that he was angry at God for taking away his sisters. And yet, Berger writes, when I think about that conversation now, what stands out is not his anger, but that he still maintained his relationship with God, like a child fleetingly furious at a parent, but knowing the bond will never be broken. In contrast, Princeton bioethic professor Peter Singer recalled that his grandmother told her family in Melbourne, Australia, that if God takes such a good man as my husband, I'm not going to follow his laws. Former Israeli Knesset member Rabbi Dov Lipman, meanwhile, recalled experiencing what he called the freezing cold of an Auschwitz winter during a visit there. I called my grandmother when I returned to Israel and asked her how she survived the cold. I explained to her that I was bundled up in many layers, including gloves, thermal socks, and a hat covering my ears, and I still lost feeling in my fingers and toes after just a few hours in Auschwitz. I wanted to know how she withstood that same cold wearing far less. She replied that she had no idea, and she guesses that it was simply meant to be that she should survive and mother her children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Survival, despite that cold and suffering, was miraculous and superhuman, and has shown me, he writes, another insight regarding how one can see God and his role in the Holocaust. These and other defining memories and narratives are the spark behind the essays of God, Face, and Identity from the Ashes. Each of the contributors to this book received a unique legacy, and each put into words how this legacy has shaped his or her life, thoughts, mindset, and career. In the course of editing the book, I realized that despite their author's starkly different perspective, they had one wholly unexpected common characteristic, an almost unfailing optimism. What seems to me to unite the diverse contributors, regardless of religious or political orientation, is a conviction that the legacy of memory we have received from our parents or grandparents is a source of strength rather than despondency, and a determination to apply that legacy in constructive, forward-looking ways that might inspire not just Jews, but all human beings, especially those whose families have been the victims of genocide, crimes against humanity, or other dire catastrophes and atrocities. The resilience of the survivors upon emerging from the Nazi death camps and other sites of persecution and oppression, and their ability to not just rebuild their lives, but teach their children and grandchildren by example to continue to have faith in humankind, is evidence, to me at least, that a dawn follows even the darkest of nights. I thank you.
And we have time for questions and comments.
Okay. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that a common denominator was optimism.
Yes.
Is it possible that the people you invited were pre-selected for that quality because they were prominent or successful? Did you try to get people possibly who tried and not such success? See how they felt about their legacy?
The answer to your question is yes, absolutely. It's not only possible. Let me put it slightly differently. We have had a fair number, if not a surfeit, of books looking at children of survivors, and survivors too for that matter, but mainly children of survivors, through a psychosocial prism. And those were written by, in large part, mental health specialists, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, you name it. And they all analyze supposed traumas and concerns, which, by the way, are all perfectly valid for some. But, as I write in the introduction to the book, it is as if one were to determine the drinking habits of the American public as a whole using control groups made up exclusively of members of Alcoholics Anonymous. What the therapists who wrote the books basically were doing were taking the people who had come to them for treatment or for support or for counseling as representative of the entirety. And they are not. They are representative of part of the entirety. And you do not take all returning American veterans from Vietnam and basically categorize them according to those who suffered from Agent Orange syndrome. So that, yes, what the book was intended to do was to demonstrate that there's another side to the story, and this is a side of those who prevailed. One of the authors in the book, a family therapist by the name of Esther Perel, writes that in her community, her survivor community in Antwerp, and in the Antwerp of the 1950s, everyone was a survivor, and everyone was basically from Poland, and everyone spoke Yiddish. She said there were two kinds of survivors. Those who had remained alive, and those who lived. And there was a difference, because some were tethered to the ground, afraid, and some basically resumed their lives and wanted to do something with it. And what I think we need to do, we cannot escape the fact that for some people, certainly for survivors, I will never question a survivor's means of dealing with it. And in fact, one of the most poignant pieces to me in the book is by a colleague of mine who happens to be as close to Haredi as you can, certainly in his personal observance. He is an ordained rabbi. He has smicha but doesn't function as a rabbi, who writes that the one of his teachers, the sort of spiritual guide, the mashgiach at his yeshiva, once told him that he would never question a survivor who had lost faith in God. That, you know, that you can't do that. You can't tell them after what they had experienced. On the other hand, they were only part of the picture. As we know, there were those who emerged with faith, there were those who emerged with optimism, there were those who turned away from religion, there were those who spoke, there were those who didn't. And we, the children and grandchildren, have to reflect that totality. What I also did want the book to accomplish is to provide at least some inspiration and hope to victims and descendants of victims of other genocides and other catastrophes. Because, look, if our parents or grandparents could emerge from the camps 70 years ago, tortured, starved, broken, alone, left without communities to go back to, without families. And if they were able to start new lives for themselves, create new families, settle in new communities with a different language, where they had to start from scratch, whether in Israel or the United States or Canada, I assure you, in Poland and in Hungary, people didn't grow up speaking Hebrew, they didn't grow up speaking English, they didn't grow up speaking French, they had to, or Spanish if they went to Argentina or Brazil. They had to learn new languages, and they did, and integrate themselves into new communities, and they did. And if their children and grandchildren can be rabbis, judges, government members in Israel, the United States, or Great Britain, historians, doctors, other type of scholars, philanthropists, you name it, well, then there's absolutely no reason why the survivors and descendants of survivors of the genocide in Rwanda or in Darfur or in Bosnia cannot do the same. And by the way, lest anybody becomes overly chauvinistic, and as Dr. Eisen will know, we Jews are quite capable of being overly chauvinistic. It's not one of our admirable traits. We're not the first to overcome adversity, even in the modern era. Look at what the descendants of the Armenian genocide, the 100th anniversary of which we are now observing, have been able to accomplish in their diaspora. And if a Vartan Gregorian was able to emerge out of that cataclysm, well, it's possible for others as well. And that's one of the reasons I really hope that the book will not only be read by Jews or survivors, but will have some resonance beyond it, because I do want others to understand that they are not alone. And again, just before going to the next question, one of the contributors to the book, Tally Nates, is the director of the Holocaust and Genocide Center in Johannesburg. And she writes about going to Rwanda and explaining to a survivor of the Rwandan genocide that a generation earlier, whites had done that to other whites a continent away, which did not necessarily ease that Rwandan, that Tutsi survivor's own pain, but perhaps made him understand, made him realize, well, if it happened to them and life continued, maybe life can continue for me as well. Yes?
I'm not sure exactly how to say this, but it's crossed my mind as well. I feel sometimes, and I don't know if it's because of the Holocaust or just past millennia, that there might be an oversensitivity on the issue of anti-Semitism, particularly in Europe now. Now, I'm not saying anti-Semitism doesn't exist. Oh, it will. But on the other hand, sometimes anti-Semitism can be seen where it maybe doesn't exist. It may be just the way individuals react to other individuals, because that's the easy shot. Now, that's obviously an individual basis and not a group basis, but I'm thinking of something, you know, after this incident in this massacre in Paris, that it was, if anything, I think it seemed to galvanize many of the citizens against what was going on, that Jews should have been attacked. Because, you know what, maybe it brought home the possibility that they too can become too easily the victims of something so overwhelming that it becomes so unfocused, it trashes everybody. I think in a way that's a good reaction too. But again, it's a question of what level of anti-Semitism exists. I say it exists, it's never gonna go away, but could there perhaps be an overreaction? Heighten it too much?
Well, you know, you do, perception. Well, you remind me, and probably Yom HaShoah is not the appropriate time to tell jokes, but you do remind me of the story of the fellow who comes home dejected after being rejected for a position as a radio announcer. And his friends say, "What happened, Moshe? You were so sure you were going to get it. How come you didn't get it?" And he says, "Well, anti-Semitism." So I mean, yes, you are.
No, you made your point.
The problem is, look, yeah. The problem. I mean, I don't want to make light of it.
No, you're not.
We in this country actually live in a bubble.
All right.
The United States has virtually no anti-Semitism of consequence, and you, as a sociologist, you may disagree. I mean, we have. Of course we have. And we have white supremacists, and we have Louis Farrakhan, and whatever it is. But there really is no fear. And we are in a community where we are pretty much surrounded by neighbors, most of whom, or many of whom, are members of minorities, and it works. What is going on in Europe is actually quite frightening.
All right.
Because we have a convergence of a couple of real problems. We have radical Islam on the one hand, which is wreaking its own little havoc. We've got the sort of ongoing extreme left anti-Semitism that we've also had to deal with and sort of become accustomed to. Mm-hmm. And we now have a really unhealthy resurgence in many parts of Europe of neo-Nazism and right-wing anti-Semitism, which for the better part of a generation plus after the Holocaust, after World War II, had been kept suppressed. Mm-hmm. And people erroneously thought it had disappeared. Well, guess what? The Nazis, those who had been ideological Nazis and anti-Semites and who had been quite happy in Germany, in Hungary, in Ukraine, wherever it was, in the perpetration of the Final Solution, mm-hmm. did not become mirabile dictu on May 9th, 1945, wonderful, warm Democrat with a liberal spirit. And what is it exactly you think they told their children and their grandchildren in the quiet of their kitchen and home when they were actually saying, you know, that was, those were really good days. Problem is these characters are coming back up. On the other hand, where I do agree with you, and where I take issue with some in the Jewish community, it is not 1933. Right. It is not 1939 for exactly the reason you mentioned. With the possible exception of two governments, every single government, and certainly every major government in Europe, is supporting us, is siding with us, is basically condemning anti-Semitism
or
and not
us, the Jews,
the Jews
or the Americans.
No, the Jews.
Oh, okay.
I mean, anti-Semitism is condemned. Let me just give you the last example. You mentioned the Charlie Hebdo and kosher supermarket incident. Well, after that, the French government did not deploy 20,000 armed troops to protect every periodical and newspaper and magazine around France. They did deploy 20,000 armed troops to protect and guard synagogues, Jewish schools, and Jewish institutions. Now, we wish it weren't necessary.
Right.
It's a little bit frightening, and I was in Paris recently with my wife, and we passed by the Great Synagogue, and sort of frightening to see soldiers and mufti with serious machine guns standing there.
The Penn Station.
But on the other hand, it's also somewhat reassuring to say, you know what? These guys are protecting the school. The anti-Semites have become the enemy. Minor.
Thank you very much. Awesome. I do want to thank our Chancellor Arne Eisen for joining us this evening. It's a pleasure to have you. And all of you for joining us as well. As you can see, there are copies of the books available for purchase with all of the wonderful essays that you've heard just a little bit about. Now you can learn more about them. They're available for $25. The library is handling the finances, so cash would be preferred. If you've got a check, please write it to the Library of the Jewish Theological Seminary. But the author will be happy to do signings. I also want want to draw your attention to the fact that we've got other events upcoming. The library is sponsoring another book talk. This is on May 5th. Rabbi Marvin Toker will discuss his new book, Pepper, Silk, and Ivory, about Jewish communities around the world that he's worked with that are quite unlike some of those that we take for granted as typically Jewish. I also want to draw your attention to the fact that next Tuesday there will be a very important, and in view of who the speakers will be, a superb program which asks the question about the kind of conversation the American Jewish community can or cannot have these days about Israel. The speakers will be J.J. Goldberg, Jonathan Tobin, and Rabbi Melissa Weintraub. So I will put cards, hand these out. Please feel free to sign up for this and come by. It will also be simulcast so that your friends and relatives out there who might be interested in the topic can join in. Again, thank you very much. The library is open late this evening, so no need to rush out. But if you'd like the book so that the author doesn't have to stay too late, please come up right away. Again, good night.
I'm going to ask you a favor. Mm. David?
What's that?
Can I send you a check?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. Do you trust me?